Maybe. Probably not, though. I always tell people not to lie to the telepath. It sucks to realize that my rules don't swing both ways.
Yours too, Sarahs, said Artie.
He paused.
Everything okay with you? You sound tense.
Covenant's in town, remember? We're bunking in an undisclosed location with what feels like half the cast of the Muppet Show, since Verity doesn't want any of us to wind up dead. And Uncle Mike is here, which means everything's been booby-trapped.
I bet Antimony would love it there.
I laughed at that, opening my eyes. I was at the top of the stairs by then. I needed to be able to see if I wanted to find my room. She'd be sawing holes in the floor so she could make actual pit traps, and we'd never get our security deposit back.
I said she'd love it, not that she'd be useful.
Artie sounded like he was buying my story, which helped me relax even more.
Any chance you'll be back online tonight?
Well, I glanced guiltily down at the slaughterhouse floor. Everyone seemed very busy getting ready for battle. Uncle Mike was deep in conversation with the mice on the table. Ryan was on the phone. Eastis was relacing her boots. None of them appeared to have particularly noticed that I was gone. That didn't mean I was off the hook. No, I don't think so. We're doing a field thing, and Uncle Mike wants me to be there.
You're doing a field thing? You hate field things.
That doesn't stop Vary from making me do them every other weekend.
No, but you always complain about them, and you're not complaining now.
It's impossible to pick up thoughts through the phone, and for once I was glad. The anxiety in Artie's voice was loud enough without any help from my telepathy.
Why aren't you complaining, Sarah? Are you really okay?
I'm fine, Artie, I said, and stepped into the barren little office that was, for the time being, my bedroom. I sank down onto the air mattress, sighing in time with the little hiss it made as I settled. I'm stressed, and I'm scared, and I'm afraid somebody's going to get hurt before this is over. But I'm fine. Honest. I'd really rather hear about how you are, if that's cool. I need to not think about things here for a little while.
Have you been to the comic book store yet this week?
A smile tugged at my lips. No, I have not, I said. Things have been a little too hectic around here for me to get down to Midtown Comics. Have I missed anything important?
Not important, necessarily, but definitely cool. See,
Artie began telling me about the latest developments in the Marvel and DC superhero universes, speaking with an enthusiastic shorthand of the true aficionado. That wasn't a problem for me. I've been reading comics for as long as I can remember. Seeing faces drawn on paper helps me recognize them in real life, or at least helps me recognize the emotions they're trying to convey. The encyclopedic knowledge of mutants and superhumans is really just an unexpected bonus. I curled up on the air mattress with one arm tucked beneath my head as a makeshift pillow while I listened to Artie talk. When he paused, I made the appropriate encouraging noises, getting him started again. In the comic books, the good guys might lose for an issue, but they always won by the end of the story arc, and death was never forever. I liked the comics. I couldn't live there, but for a little while, I could pretend. Not for long enough. Someone knocked gently on my doorframe. I sat up, the phone still pressed against my ear. Uncle Mike was standing there, and I didn't need to be good at reading faces to understand how grim his was.
"It's time,"
he said. "Okay," I whispered.
"Sarah?"
asked Artie.
"What's up?"
"Nothing. Uncle Mike just needs me. It's time to go. Stay safe, okay? I'll call you soon." If I was alive. If any of us were still alive.
"Okay, Sars. Miss you."
"Miss you too," I said, and hung up the phone. Fun facts about cuckoo biology. We can't bleed, not the way mammals do. But we can cry. I got up and followed Uncle Mike out of the room, and I cried the whole way. Chapter 19. You know what, honey? You're right. It's time to change my approach. Can you give me one of those nice concussion grenades? Alice Healy. The Freak Show, a highly specialized nightclub somewhere in Manhattan. We left Sunil and Roshak behind when the rest of us left the nest. There was no way of knowing whether Verity had given up our location, and so Kitty was calling some of her relatives to come and take the Medora away to some place Verity didn't know. The brothers Medora weren't happy about spending quality time with the city's boogeyman population, but they understood that it was the only way we could keep them safe, since taking them into battle with us would have been an even worse idea. It was a good thing the Medora weren't coming, since Uncle Mike's car was barely big enough as it was. I got the front seat. No one really wanted to snuggle up to the touch-activated telepath, while Eustace, Ryan, and Dominic were crammed into the back. It would have been funny if the situation hadn't been so dire. I couldn't stop thinking about how much Verity would have laughed if she'd seen her boyfriend wedged between two therianthropes like that. She probably would have taken a dozen pictures with her phone and threatened to use them for her Christmas cards. Thinking about Verity's laughter helped me keep my shields up, which kept me from picking up on the thoughts of the people around me. That was good. The vague dread filling the car was stomach-churning enough without adding any stronger signals. Being a telepath in a largely non-telepathic society means the onus of not reading people's minds is entirely on me. Almost no one maintains a decent mental shield on purpose, and the ones who do it accidentally are rare enough to be a miracle. At least Eustace wasn't worried. Her emotional state was pure excitement, and a particularly bloody sort of anticipation. It said something about the day I'd been having that this was reassuring.
"We're here," said Uncle Mike.
The back seat emptied like a clown car at the circus, everyone moving to be the first one out. Uncle Mike moved at a more leisurely pace, still efficient, but aware that no amount of hurry was going to make up for an assload of support and ammunition. I was somewhere in the middle, clearing the car while Uncle Mike was still setting the alarm. The other three were almost to the freak show doors. I hurried to catch up. The ticket booth was empty when I got there, and the doors themselves were closed and locked. According to the posters advertising the freak show's virtues, the club should have been open, even if this wasn't anything like peak business hours. I guess when your friendly neighborhood cryptozoologist gets herself taken by her less friendly relations, staying closed starts looking like the better option.
"Now what?" demanded Dominic.
"Chill," said Ryan.
He knocked four times, paused, and knocked twice more. There was an answering knock from inside. Ryan knocked again.
"This code is stupid," said Eustace. "We should simply allow whomever is manning the door to eat anyone unwelcome. People we do not want coming around would quickly cease."
"Or they'd come back with tanks," said Ryan.
"Strategic thinking means not eating your enemies all the time."
"I hate strategic thinking," grumbled Eustace.
Kitty opened the door. I blinked. She was wearing the modern equivalent of boogeyman cultural dress. Dark gray leggings and a knee-length dress a few shades lighter, cut to accommodate the length and flexibility of her limbs. Her hair was loose around her face, accentuating the strangeness of seeing her like this. Kitty could never pass perfectly for human. Very few types of cryptid can. A lot of the ones who come close, like Kitty, resent me for how easily I can move through the human world, even if they forget why they resent me the second I'm out of their sight. Still, she normally wore human clothing and kept her hair neatly styled. The monster under the bed look wasn't normal for her. If she was wearing a boogeyman's array, she meant business.
"Come on in," she said. "Everybody's waiting."
"Thank you again, Kitty," said Uncle Mike,
and stepped into the freak show. Ryan and Eustace followed. Dominic moved to do the same. Kitty stepped between him and the opening, setting her hand flat against his chest. She wasn't exerting nearly enough pressure to hold him in place, but he still stopped, looking at her gravely.
"This is your fault," she said.
I'm going to bet that you've already been threatened to within an inch of your worthless life, so I'm not going to bother. I'm just going to make you a promise. If the Price Girl dies, that's sad. But she knew this job was dangerous when she took it. If a single cryptid who didn't choose to walk into this fight dies, just one, I will be the monster in your closet for the rest of your life. If not me, then my cousins and their cousins until you've paid for your sins. Do I make myself clear?
A boogeyman threatening a trained operative from the Covenant of St. George should have been funny. It wasn't, because I didn't have to be a telepath to know Kitty meant it. If Dominic failed, she was going to throw the weight of her entire species at destroying him. I almost felt sorry for the man, but Dominic didn't waste time with anything as useless as self-pity. He just nodded and said, "I understand, and I accept your punishment as just." Kitty blinked, surprise rolling off her like fog. She dropped her hand. "Well then," she said, sounding bewildered. "As long as we've got that straight." Then she stepped aside, letting Dominic into the freak show. I moved to follow. Her hand flashed up again.
"Hold it," she said. "Who are you again?"
Oh, fudgesicles.
This is life as a cuckoo. Sometimes your allies will cease to be your allies in the middle of a bad situation because your distress signals are overwhelming the low-grade, "We should be friends, let's be besties," beacon that cuckoos put out at all times. Boogeymen are more resistant than humans, maybe because they made easier targets in the days before they learned to lock their doors against us. Easier, not preferred. Cuckoos are happiest when they blend in, and we blend in best with humans.
"Sarah Zellaby," I said, and quoted her own words back at her. "Verity's little adopted cousin with the big blue eyes and the clear antifreeze for blood. Does that ring any bells?" Kitty's eyes widened, a response I didn't have to be good with faces to understand.
"You're a cuckoo."
"Yes, but I'm a good cuckoo. I swear, and we've met before like a dozen times. You usually remember me. I'm sorry, I'm so freaked out that I'm broadcasting." I tried to focus on building a mental wall between us. It was harder than normal. Stress was making everything slippery. Kitty's suspicion slowly gave way to recognition.
"Sarah?"
"Yes," I said, and smiled a little, hopefully. "Sorry for the whammy. I just didn't know it was going to be that bad."
"Just try to keep it under wraps while we're inside," she said, lowering her hand. "I don't want you starting a riot."
It was a lot more likely that I'd start a new branch of the Everybody Protect Sarah Club, but I didn't say anything. I just stepped past Kitty. She closed and locked the door behind me. I waited for her to finish, and we walked together down the canvas-draped corridor to the main room, where, by the sounds of things, there was quite a party going on. The mental noise hit a second after the audible noise did. At least 2 or 3 dozen people, almost as many different species, and all of them doing their best not to panic. I gasped. I couldn't help myself. The wall I'd built to keep from broadcasting to Kitty was good, but it was nowhere near good enough to withstand the assault waiting at the end of the hall.
"Are you okay?" asked Kitty.
"What?" I hadn't even realized that I wasn't walking anymore. My legs had stopped moving without conscious command, taking themselves out of the equation while I did the complicated mental math of self-protection. I needed better walls, bigger walls, walls that could keep me from becoming so overwhelmed that I whammied everyone in the room just to keep them from hurting me.
"Are you okay?" repeated Kitty. "You look like you're about to throw up."
I was considering it. "I'll be fine," I said. "There's just a lot of focused anxiety in here. And it was all about my cousin, or at least about the people who had her. That, coupled with my having met everyone in the freak show at one point or another, explain the severity of my reaction. Give me a second."
"Those are in pretty short supply, cuckoo girl," said Kitty.
But she waited with me while I got myself under control, and I was grateful for that. It's easier to build a telepathic wall when you have someone nearby you can build it against, and Kitty was a lot less angry than some of the people in the main room. Once I was sure I wouldn't fall apart, I nodded, and Kitty led the rest of the way into the freak show. The room looked strange, seen during the daylight. The lights were turned up to full, exposing the scuffs on the floor and the well-repaired tears in the upholstery. I could see scars on the ceiling where the old stripper poles had been removed. On the whole, though, the decor stood up pretty well to being visible, probably because it was designed by Kitty, and Kitty, like all boogeymen, could see perfectly well in the dark. She might be willing to live with a little wear and tear, but who wants to own a club they can't be proud of? I wasn't surprised by the number of people who were turned toward the door, waiting for us. I'd already detected their presence, and my head still throbbed a little from the shock of it. I was, however, gratified. They could have run. They could have hidden themselves away and let Verity take whatever punishment the Covenant wanted to dish out. Instead, when the call for help was sounded, they came. Sure, some of them were probably like Eestis, who would take any excuse to hurt things without getting in trouble for it, but I didn't care. They came. That was enough for me. Kitty clapped her hands, walking ahead and leaving me standing in the doorway.
"Okay, people, nothing to see here, and we have a rescue mission to mount."
She looked at Dominic.
"That's your cue, Covenant boy. Impress us with your willingness to sell out your former allies." "Think you could have made that sound any worse, Kitty?"
asked Ryan.
"Oh, trust me, I could still make it sound worse," said Kitty. "I have a gift."
Dominic listened in silence, his posture impassive and unyielding. I was pretty sure his expression was meant to match. Internally, he was a different story, broadcasting anxiety and remorse so loudly that it was leaking through my shielding. I took a breath, focusing on shoring up the walls between me and the rest of the room a little bit better.
"Before we go any further with this, and yes, knowing that we have very little time, I need to be sure you understand that I did not make the decision to come to you lightly," said Dominic.
There was a slight quiver to his voice. Anyone who didn't know him would probably miss it. I couldn't stop hearing it.
"I was raised to believe that almost everyone in this room was a soulless monster, and that the humans among you were traitors to their species. I was misled, and I allowed it, because it was all I knew. I'm sorry."
Muttering greeted the first part of his statement, replaced by silence and a general feeling of surprise as he continued. I stepped out of the doorway, moving to stand next to Kitty.
"I was willing to let the Covenant come and go unhindered, helping Verity protect you and your families until the danger had passed. Unfortunately, that ceased to be an option when they took her. I understand that I am asking you to challenge an organization that wants nothing more than your extinction. I have nowhere else to turn, and Verity has no other options."
"Will they kill her?" asked Carol. She wasn't wearing her wig, and the snakes atop her head hissed and writhed in response to her agitation.
"Sadly, no," said Dominic.
Ryan took a step toward him, seeming to get almost a foot taller in the process. My eyes weren't deceiving me. The therianthrope was growing. Never a good sign.
"What did you say?" he growled. "If they were going to kill her, we could create a gas leak in the building and blow them all to Kingdom Come," said Dominic.
If having a shift-primed Tanuki menacing him was not a problem, he wasn't letting it show.
"Since they're not going to kill her any time soon, we have to come up with a solution that doesn't include killing her ourselves."
"Oh,"
said Ryan suspiciously. He didn't shrink back down to his original size. I guess some things take time.
"As I was saying, no, the Covenant will not kill her. It would be, if you will forgive me an unpleasant turn of phrase, wasteful. Verity Price represents something they have not had in generations. She is a source of information about her family, and about the cryptids of North America. They will break her, through whatever means necessary, and then they will drain her dry."
Dominic shook his head.
"I love her, I do, But believe me when I say that the Covenant of St. George is extremely good at breaking people. She will do her best to withstand them, and I believe she'll be able to hold out much longer than many people could. In the end, she'll break. In the end, everyone breaks.
So what do we do?
Asked Angel. The Covenant is using a dockside warehouse as their temporary headquarters while here in town. Their hotel rooms have already been abandoned. Presumably all three of them have moved into the warehouse to supervise their prisoner and to fortify their defenses against me. Now Dominic's voice turned even grimmer. I didn't tell them Verity existed. I vanished when she was taken. And our family has a history of converting Covenant agents to our way of thinking, I said. They've probably already decided that Dominic is no longer on the right side.
That is true, said Dominic.
In their eyes, I am as much of a monster as any of you, if not more. After all, I saw the light and turned it aside.
Congratulations, said Eustace primly.
Nervous laughter spread through the room like a stain. Uncle Mike allowed it for a moment before stepping forward, saying,
"Okay, folks, get it together. My niece needs saving."
He glanced to Dominic, who nodded. Uncle Mike nodded back before he continued.
"We know where they are, and we know how many of them we're going up against. We also know they may have bitten off more than they could chew when they took Verity. If they're hoping to get information out of her, that means they're keeping her awake and reasonably aware of what's going on. Now, I don't know about the rest of you, but I've seen that girl kick a boundary imp's ass when she had a concussion and a broken arm. If they think she's just going to sit there and let them ask their questions, they're going to find themselves with a nasty surprise. That works in our favor.
If things are so slanted in our favor, what are we still doing here?
Asked a Pliny's Gorgon I vaguely recognized as being one of the newer members of the staff. He crossed his arms, posture daring Dominic and Uncle Mike to come up with an answer he'd believe. The snakes on his head hissed ominously, twining themselves together in a sinuous braid which undid itself just as quickly. I thought his name was Joe. Maybe. Whatever his name. He was tall, unfriendly, and crowned with venomous snakes. That alone made him worth listening to, if only so his hair didn't start biting people.
"Because there's this little factor called the unknown," said Uncle Mike. "We need to worry about what we don't know."
The three Covenant operatives are highly skilled in their own areas, and are not going to be inclined to go gently on us, said Dominic. Peter Brandt is a demolitions expert. Robert Bullard is a tactical specialist. Between the two of them, they are very likely to have turned the warehouse into a death trap for anyone coming in without knowing how to avoid the tripwires.
Margaret?
He hesitated. Margaret is a Healy, I said. Several heads turned toward me, like everyone had forgotten that I was there. Sadly, they probably had. Stupid cuckoo powers. For those of you who don't know what that means, she's like an evil Verity. She won't stop hitting you just because you say you're going to be good. You changed your mind, and you'd like to go home now. That means that no matter how heavily weighted we think this equation is in our favor, we have to be better than the probabilities. We have to be absolutely certain of what we're walking into.
Nobody's absolutely sure of anything, cuckoo girl, said Kitty, sending mutters through some of the staffers who had managed to forget what I was.
Stupid, stupid cuckoo powers.
Sometimes I get tired of apologizing for my species to the same person a dozen times.
How are we supposed to know that we're not all walking into a trap?
We employ spies,
said Uncle Mike, dipping his hand into a pocket. When he pulled it out again, one of the younger mouse priests was standing proudly on his palm.
Hail!
Squeaked the mouse. Silence reigned. No one's sure whether Aeslin mice are extinct except for the family's colony, or whether they just like their privacy. Whichever the answer, most people have only heard of them in passing, and they're largely regarded as a weird sort of fairy tale, Cinderella's mice without the vegetable transport and poor footwear choices.
but they're the only species of talking mouse that anyone has found so far, and so there wasn't much question about what Uncle Mike was holding. The only question was how.
"Hello, Mouse," said Eustace, sounding pleased.
"What the?" said Kitty.
"Is that an Aislinn mouse?"
asked Joe.
"My hair is hungry," announced Carol.
That brought the conversation to its second screeching halt in as many minutes, as everyone turned to stare at the Gorgon. Carol blushed, ducking her head slightly while radiating embarrassment. She was telling the truth about her hair. The individual snakes were stretching toward the mouse, their mouths open and their tongues scenting the air.
"This just gets better and better," muttered Ryan.
I didn't disagree. Uncle Mike ignored them all in favor of focusing on what mattered, the plan, rather than what didn't, everything else.
"We've got half a dozen volunteers from Verity's resident Aislinn colony. They're going to go in, scout the place for traps, and report back. That lets us get a feeling for the lay of the land before we put ourselves in harm's way."
"You mean she wasn't just bragging when she said she had a colony of Aislinn living with her?" asked Kitty. Dominic snorted.
"Bragging? No. Complaining vociferously? Almost certainly. While she is quite fond of her resident rodents, she seems to enjoy complaining about them as she does little else. The family has coexisted with Aislinn mice for generations, which brings us to the one possible flaw in this plan," said Uncle Mike. "We don't know for sure that this Margaret woman doesn't have a colony of her own. It seems unlikely given the Covenant's stance on cryptids, but the original colony was harbored before the family defected."
"If we encounter heretics while on the search for our brave priestess, we will smite them down with the fury of 1,000 angry rolling pins," squeaked the mouse.
"Don't know what that means, really. I've got to assume it's pretty dire since it's coming from a talking mouse," said Uncle Mike. "Now, I don't know about the rest of you, but I'm going to go and rescue my niece from the Covenant of St. George. Who's with me?"
"I am," said Dominic.
"It will be a pleasing diversion," said Eustace.
"Verity's my friend," said Ryan.
"These people give humans a bad name," said Angel.
"We're with you," said a voice from the back of the room.
I turned to see Priscilla standing in the door to the hall. She must have been speaking for the dragons while Candy's pregnancy kept her confined to the nest. More dragons stood to either side of her, both the European and Chinese varieties. Several of the lizard-like servitors that Verity insisted on calling Sleestacks were behind them. All of them were holding weapons.
"All right, then," said Uncle Mike.
He sounded pleased. Who wouldn't be, when they had just been handed their very own cryptid army?
"Now we're cooking with gas. Let's go get Verity back."
This time, when the mouse cheered, so did everybody else. One way or another, it was time to go and face the Covenant of St. George. "Hang on, Verity," I thought, wishing there was any chance at all that she was in a position to hear me. "We're on our way. Just hang on."
Chapter 20. I'll never understand why people think kidnapping is a good way to solve their problems. Near as I can tell, it just makes more problems that you need to solve. And who are you going to kidnap then? Francis Brown. An unknown location in the city of Manhattan, returning to our original narrator, who has just regained consciousness after a nasty blow to the head. I knew three things even before I opened my eyes. That I was somewhere enclosed, probably no larger than a bathroom stall. That someone had changed my clothes. Nothing was riding the way it should have, which probably meant my weapons were also gone. And that I was in serious trouble. Then I raised my aching head, opened my eyes, and added a fourth thing to the list. Wherever I was, it was pitch black. No natural or artificial light, and I'm not a boogeyman. I can't see in the dark. Well, shit, I thought. I was smart enough not to say it out loud.
There was no point in letting my captors know I was awake before I absolutely had to. The last thing I remembered was Margaret Healy's gun slamming into the back of my head and the meaty, deadweight sound of my body hitting the rooftop. Not the sort of thing I like to go to sleep on. I'm more of the dance until you can't feel your knees, two or three rounds of really fun sex, wine cooler, bed, school of thought. Still, we all have to work with what we're given in this life, and what I'd been given was a crazy cousin from England who seemed to think my skull was a piñata. At least she hadn't managed to hit me hard enough to make the candy come out. I could turn my head easily enough, and while I couldn't see a damn thing, I was reasonably confident that it was due to a lack of light, not because she had somehow knocked my optic nerves offline. I sat up a little straighter. The gesture caused the chains holding my wrists to the wall to pull up tight, clanking faintly. "Damn," I whispered, not bothering to internalize it this time. I hadn't even realized I was chained until I tried to move. That was an amateur mistake. I should have assumed I was bound the second I woke up and planned accordingly. Not that there was much I could have done in the dark, presumably unarmed, with a head sore enough to make me suspect concussion. Maybe I was being hard on myself. And maybe that didn't matter, since Margaret and her goons weren't going to go easy on me just because I wasn't feeling at the top of my game. I took a deep breath, ignoring the sick swimming sensation in my head, and tugged against the chains that bound me. There was barely a foot of give, and by chaining me to a wall, rather than tying me to the chair that I was sitting in, the Covenant had managed to deny me the leverage I might have otherwise used against them. My left leg was free. My right leg wasn't. That made sense, too. It didn't totally immobilize me, and if they wanted me to stay functional for any length of time, they were going to want me to have some capacity for movement. Enough to keep the blood flowing, at least, since bed sores and gangrene are nobody's friends. That was a sobering thought all by itself. People who plan to kill you quickly don't worry about tying you up so that you can still move enough to keep your circulation good. People who plan to torture you for everything you can tell them about your family and the cryptids you've spent your whole life protecting do. And if what I knew about the Covenant was accurate, they wouldn't view torturing me as a bad thing. God told them it was all cool, as long as when it was over, they got to kill a dragon or two. Antimony suggested once that we should all carry suicide pills, just in case a situation like this one came up. Alex and I both laughed at her. I told her that there was no way I'd ever let a situation like this one be a problem. I'd die before I let myself be taken that way. Those were my exact words. Yet here I was, captive for the second time since I arrived in New York. And this time it wasn't just a harmless little snake cult intending to use me as a virgin sacrifice. This time it was the Covenant of St. George. Worse, this time it was family. And as many people have pointed out over the years, there's nobody in this world who can hurt you like family can. I took a few deep breaths to calm myself down before carefully tugging on each of the chains in turn, looking for differences in how they moved. The Covenant was pretty good at chaining people up. I had to give them that. I doubt I could have done a better job. Antimony probably could, but that's because Antimony focused on keeping people as far away from her as possible, and when she couldn't do that, she liked to be sure they'd stay where she put them. Okay, so I was chained up, in the dark, with no idea of where I was. I shifted a little, feeling loose fabric around me, and added, wearing a bathrobe instead of real clothing, to my list of problems. The material was rough enough to be cheap, meaning it had probably been purchased from a gift shop, not stolen from one of Sarah's high-end hotels. My feet were bare. If they'd taken my clothes, they'd taken my weapons. I was as close to helpless as I was ever going to get, and that pissed me off. Taking another slow breath, I closed my eyes and thought, as hard as I could. Sarah, can you hear me? There was no response, and I realized that even the low-grade telepathic static of her presence was gone. I pushed back a surge of panic. There was no reason to suspect that they'd managed to track Sarah down while I was unconscious, and that meant one of two things. Either I was still under the influence of Margaret's telepathy-blocking charm, or the Covenant had already moved me out of New York, and I was outside Sarah's normal broadcast range. She'd be looking for me. They all would. But if I was too far for her to find telepathically, she wouldn't know what to do. She wouldn't have another way to start looking. If she was smart, and Uncle Mike would make her be smart if he had to, she was already on a plane back to Ohio to hole up with her parents. Two cuckoos in one house meant the Covenant would never find them, no matter how hard they were looking. Sarah and Angela have been the family escape plan for a generation now. I realized I was thinking like I was already lost, and I embraced it. It wasn't the same as giving up. I didn't expect the Covenant to kill me fast, and the longer they kept me alive, the better my chances became. But if my family thought I was out of reach, they might give up on me, and we might be able to minimize the damage. There was no way they were going to do that, but it was a nice thought. There was a soft click from one wall, like a lock was being turned. Nice as it would have been to stare defiantly at the door as it opened, I wasn't in the mood to have my retinas seared after sitting in the dark for this long. I turned my face to the side. It was a bad choice. The actual door was in the wall I was facing now, and as it swung open, a blast of industrial white light streamed into the room, framing the outline of Margaret Healy.
"I see you're awake," she said pleasantly.
That was more frightening than any threats she could have made.
"That's good. We've got quite a lot to talk about, you and I."
"You could have invited me to coffee," I said, squinting as I waited for my eyes to stop watering. "I don't know how you do things in Europe, but here in America, we usually start our family reunions with something a little less high impact than assault and kidnapping."
"You hit me first," Margaret shot back.
Her pleasant tone didn't waver.
"Besides which, you're not much of one to talk, since the first thing you ever did was lie to me. Where did you leave that girl who was with you? Sandy, I believe you said her name was?"
There was no way I was going to remind her that Sarah was the one who hit her, not me.
"She has nothing to do with this," I said. "She's just someone I met at a dance class. Leave her alone."
"That's the thing about traitors and liars. You can't believe a word they say. She lied for you. She tried to cover for you. Now, why would she do that if she had nothing to do with this?"
Margaret flipped a switch next to the door. The overheads came on, filling the room with more light. This didn't hurt as much. My eyes were adjusting.
"Your name isn't even Valerie, is it?"
"Does it matter?" Margaret smiled.
"Oh, it matters. It matters a great deal. We'll need to know what name to bury you under when we're finally done with you. If you're worried for your life, don't be. You'll be with us for quite some time."
I gathered. I forced myself to relax, trying to look unconcerned. "What makes you think I'm going to talk?"
"I have a better question for you. What makes you think you've got a choice?"
Margaret lunged across the small distance between us, grabbing my hair before I had a chance to move. She yanked my head back, making it pound even harder.
"No one knows you're here. No one's coming to save you. You're going to get what you have coming to you, finally. And you're going to tell us where to find every other stinking rat in your hole."
The pain in my head helped me focus on what mattered. She was right. I was her captive, and I was pretty sure the Covenant wouldn't slap her wrists for using excessive force on me. All the advantages were hers. I put on my best tolerant reality television smile, trying to look like I wasn't even a little bit concerned about my situation.
"Oh, Christ, you're a metaphor villain, aren't you? You're the rat catcher, I'm the rat. You're here to exterminate the vermin, is that it? Wow. Do they have a cliché course that they make you guys go through before they release you into the field? Or maybe you're naturally talented. I mean, that happens, right?"
Margaret's eyes widened in confused indignation before she let go of my hair and shoved my head hard to the side.
My neck audibly cracked. I somehow managed not to squawk.
You may think you're funny now, heretic, but you won't be laughing for long.
You may as well kill me, I said, aiming for boredom rather than bravado. I wasn't sure that I was managing either.
I'm not going to tell you anything.
Aren't you?
Margaret smiled.
You've already told me plenty.
My stomach sank.
Oh?
I asked.
You're a traitor from a bloodline of traitors, but no Healy has ever been a coward. You wouldn't be telling me to kill you if you didn't have something to hide.
Margaret's smile grew, chilling me.
You're not the last of your family, and you're going to tell me where to find them all before I let you die for your sins.
I was so busy watching her face that I didn't see her tense her arm until her hand lashed out, her fist catching me square in my unprotected jaw. The lights went out, for me at least, and for a little while, the world went away again. My last thought before I lost consciousness was that I really, really hated this girl. The sound of the door opening again woke me. I cracked my eyes open just enough to see that the lights were on, and that the person standing in front of me wasn't Margaret. It was a man. Slim, dark, about my height.
Dominic.
The sight of him made me sit up a little straighter and open my eyes all the way, my heart thudding painfully in my chest. Thankfully, I managed to bite my lip before I could say his name. It wasn't him. This man was the right height. That was where the resemblance ended. His hair was dark red, not brown verging on black, and his eyes were a cool, implacable blue. His skin was pale, spattered with freckles, and he was smiling.
"Why do you people smile all the damn time?" I asked, and was instantly ashamed of how shaky my voice sounded.
Head injuries and unknown periods of captivity without food or water will do that to a girl.
"Because, love, you're our unicorn," he said.
His accent was Irish and heavier than Margaret's.
"Never thought I'd see the day."
"Wait, so first I'm a rat, and now I'm a unicorn? If you're going to be metaphor villains, maybe you should have a meeting first, come up with a nice theme and stick to it."
The man clucked his tongue, looking amused.
"Oh, you've got a mouth on you, don't you? I hoped you would. You look enough like the family standard that I assumed some other bits might breed true."
He leaned closer and murmured, with evident satisfaction.
"You may have thought you were hiding, but you never stood a chance. You look too much like your ancestors.
And yet you people lost track of us for two generations.
That sounds like a pretty good chance to me. It was always borrowed time."
He leaned in and grasped my chin, turning my head so that he could study my profile.
"You've got the price blood in you, too. Oh, and won't those stuffed shirts be horrified to realize that their little disappearing scion really did marry the American Healy girl? You get to disappoint both sides of your heritage before you die, love. There's people who'd love the chance to horrify their families like that."
He was standing close to watch me squirm. My left leg was free, and I'm a trained salsa dancer. My leg swept upward at a speed that would have seemed superhuman to anyone who'd never watched competition ballroom dance, catching the man from the Covenant squarely between the legs. The squishing feeling of his scrotum compressing against my knee was more satisfying than it probably should have been, but I didn't worry about it much. When someone chains me up and tries bargain-bin intimidation tactics on me, I figure I'm allowed to take a little pleasure in their pain.
"Ugh,"
said the man from the Covenant, his eyes going wide and glassy. His mouth dropped open as his hand fell away from my chin, letting me pull my head out of his grasp.
"Is that so?"
I asked, dropping my leg slightly before ramming it back up into his balls. His answer this time was much less coherent and substantially higher in pinch.
"Huh.
Think that's something I can discuss with my long-lost family?" I dropped my leg, preparing for a third hit.
You know what they say. Third time's the charm.
I wouldn't do that if I were you, said a male voice.
I froze, legs still held straight out between the Irishman's legs, and looked toward the door. The older of the two men from the Covenant was standing there, regarding me contemplatively. There was something that looked almost like sympathy in his eyes.
It's just that Peter doesn't care for having pretty girls smash his testicles, and while two hits you might be able to write off as having been scared and disoriented, three sort of implies premeditation.
The man, Robert, by process of elimination, had a Welsh accent, and was wearing wire-rimmed glasses, hiding the color of his eyes. His hair was a nondescript shade of sandy blonde, slowly fading into gray. I could easily have lost sight of him in a crowd. That just made him more unnerving. Covenant representatives should be easy to spot, and easier to avoid. I let my foot drop to the floor.
Thank you.
Robert walked over to Peter, putting his hands on the other man's shoulders and pulling him backward. Peter went willingly, dropping his hands to cup his crotch as he moved.
Ugh,
he said.
I think that's the right response, mate, but you shouldn't have been harassing the lady. You know she's Maggie's kin, and Maggie requested quite properly and deferentially that I not allow you to mess about with her. She understands chain of command.
Robert led Peter to the wall, where he let him go. Peter promptly leaned against it, folding forward as he continued to clutch his wounded genitals.
"Sorry about all this, miss."
It was a leading question, designed to give him my name. I had to admire that, even as I had to question the wisdom of a good cop, bad cop routine that put the bad cop in a position where he needed to take a nutshot. "Nice try," I said. "I appreciate you stopping me from making an enemy out of an enemy, but I'm not going to tell you my name."
"Your last name is Price, like your paternal grandfather. Your first name starts with the letter V, which rather limits the possibilities, since there aren't that many names for women that start at that end of the alphabet."
I must have stiffened. Robert smiled a little.
"We all have our training. You give yourself away every time you open your mouth, every time you move. I'll sort you out from top to bottom while you still think you're restricting yourself to non-committal answers and sassing back. I'm sorry about that."
"If you're sorry, don't do it," I said. "Unlock these chains and let me the hell out of here."
"Even if I wanted to, I couldn't do that. The Covenant has a need for your services, Miss Price, and your family took an oath many generations ago to answer when they were called upon. You may not uphold your oath willingly, but you will uphold it. Now, please. This would be so much easier if you worked with us, rather than against us."
"I'm going to kill her," said Peter.
He still sounded strained, but at least he was managing words now, and sentences. I probably hadn't done any permanent damage. He turned a glare on me.
"I'm going to kill you!"
"I heard you the first time," I said dismissively, and looked back to Robert. "You're not going to win. You can intimidate me as much as you want, but you're not going to win."
"I'm sorry," said Robert. "We already have."
He supported Peter with one arm as he led the other man out of the room and closed the door behind them. Once again, the sound of the lock engaging came from the wrong wall, like they had some sort of speaker set up just to disorient me. I waited for the click, and then forced myself to mentally replay the first verse and chorus of Lady Gaga's Love Game, roughly 30 seconds of music. When that was done, I allowed myself to glance up and smile. The lights were still on. Don't get me wrong, I can get a lot done in total darkness. Blind fighting is a part of the standard training package where I come from, and there was a whole summer where I wasn't allowed to eat any meal I couldn't prepare blindfolded. Lessons from that summer included, never let Verity make spaghetti with a blindfold on, and never eat anything Antimony prepares with a blindfold on.
How she got the blessed cedar ash into the oatmeal is something the world may never know. But at the end of the day, I prefer working in the light, and it's hard to case a room that you can't see. Robert Bullard said that I was giving myself away with every word I said, or didn't say. Fine. This room was doing the same thing, and I didn't even need to ask it questions. All I needed was the luxury to look around. For one thing, the walls were matte white, with no staining or discoloration of any sort. My chains weren't bolted to anything that I could see. They passed through holes cut into the wood. That, combined with how little leverage I had, told me I was in a false room, probably constructed in the middle of something much bigger. Each wall was about 5 feet long, giving my captors room to move, but not giving me much opportunity to get away. I hadn't been able to see much through the open door when Peter and Robert arrived, but what I'd been able to see gave me the impression of industrial gray. Either my false room was in a shipping container, or we were in some sort of unused factory or warehouse. I'd never actually been shipped anywhere. That was one exciting life opportunity I'd worked hard to avoid, but I was reasonably sure that I would have been able to feel the pull and roll of the tides moving the ship if we'd been at sea. So, no matter which option turned out to be the right one, we were staying in one place. For now. If there was one thing I knew for sure, it was that complacency is a killer. I had to assume that they'd be moving me at any moment, and putting me in a false room opened the potential for moving my surroundings with me. I needed to get these chains undone. But how? Most of the common cons wouldn't work on these people. They were the ones who taught them to my family in the first place. If I faked a stomach ache, they'd force charcoal and Pepto-Bismol down my throat until I stopped. If I faked demonic possession, they'd just dump holy water over my head. And so on and so on. Getting them to untie me was going to take something totally new and original, something they'd never seen before. It was really a pity that I had absolutely no idea what that something was. As for fixtures, there weren't many. This wasn't a place they were planning to keep me long-term, not if they wanted me to stay functional, and the setup argued for them wanting me to last. The chains were thick and solid. They must have brought those with them, because the chair I was sitting on was a piece of crap that looked like it was originally from IKEA. It was bolted to the floor. I leaned forward enough to study the bolts. They were generic hardware store issue, nothing special or unique. The Covenant was improvising. That was good for me. I can improvise with the best of them, and I've always gotten high marks for my freestyle. The lights on the ceiling were more generic hardware. The false room had taken work, but they hadn't been ready to put someone into it. Not yet. There was bound to be a weak spot somewhere, and I would find it. Later. My head hurt. I was chained to a wall. I was going to need to eat and pee before too much longer. But for the moment, there was nothing I could do, and so I closed my eyes, cleared my mind, and let myself slip slowly into the restorative arms of sleep. Never fight tired if you don't have to, and never let a captive recover their strength if you have any other choice. I was following the rules. Margaret wasn't. And when she came back to resume her little question-and-answer session, she was going to find out just how important some rules really are. Chapter 21 Blood is one thing, but that's not all that goes into family. The family you choose is the family that really matters. They're the ones who will keep you standing. Evelyn Baker. An unknown location in the city of Manhattan, but it's probably a shipping container or a warehouse. The sound of footsteps woke me from my doze. I cracked my eyes open just far enough to test the quality of the light. It hadn't changed. There were no windows in my little room, so the passage of time wouldn't affect things, but they also hadn't turned off the lights or tried setting up an interrogation rig. That was good. I stayed comfortably limp, waiting to see who was approaching me,
and what they wanted. I didn't have to wait for very long.
"Are you asleep?"
demanded Margaret. She sounded incredulous. Out of all the things she was expecting from me, this was apparently at the bottom of the list. I raised my head, yawning.
"I was," I said. "Now I'm not. Maybe you should try it sometime. You might be less cranky."
"I am not cranky," said Margaret. "You could have fooled me." She was dangerous, employed by the Covenant of St. George, and I was totally at her mercy. I probably shouldn't have been taking pleasure in tormenting her. At the same time, she sort of reminded me of my sister. A shorter, slimmer, more potentially murderous version of my sister, and I hadn't been able to torment Antimony in person for way too long. As long as I kept thinking of things in those terms, I wouldn't completely lose my shit. Maybe I was going to get away. Maybe I wasn't. Either way, I could keep irritating the Covenant until they killed me. It was a small thing. It was the only thing I currently had. Margaret narrowed her eyes. "Your continuing insolence won't do you any good. You're going to pay for your sins, and I will personally commend you, body and soul, into the arms of the Lord." "What sins are those exactly?" I leaned back in my chair. "I'm sorry I hit you and stole your stuff, but you're the one who picked the lock in the first place. I was just acting in self-defense." I wasn't the one who'd hit her. I didn't feel like reminding her of that fact. "You are charged with consorting with demons, conspiracy to betray the human race, and corruption of the innocent." "That's a whole lot of C," I said, through lips that felt suddenly numb. I'd been expecting two of her trumped-up charges. The third. Consorting with demons meant working with cryptids, rather than shooting them on sight. Conspiracy to betray the human race meant basically the same thing, with a side order of not shooting any cryptid who looked like they might someday accidentally be a danger to humanity. Like Eestis, who had never hurt anyone who didn't hurt her first. That I was aware of anyway, and I try to judge people by what I see, not what I suspect. But had been perfectly happy to slaughter snake cultists with extreme prejudice. By the standards of the Covenant, I was a traitor just for letting her kill the people who'd been intending to kill us. But corruption of the innocent. Dominic had been on my side all along. I was an idiot. Margaret pressed her lips into a thin line, glaring at me.
"That's right, you succubus. We know.
We know you led Dominic de Luca from the paths of righteousness, just as your ancestress led Thomas Price into sin. He may still be forgiven, but you are beyond saving."
"You know, if you're comparing me to Grandma, the one thing we have in common is that we're both descended from the Healys," I said, trying to push aside the cold, sick feeling in my stomach.
"What does that say about your family,
huh? Have you seduced and betrayed anyone recently?" She didn't punch me this time. Instead, she slapped me, her palm landing hard and stinging against my cheek. I rocked back in my chair. The manacles dug into my wrists, and I barely managed to bite my lip hard enough to keep from crying out.
"You're a selfish little bitch, just like everyone else in your tainted bloodline," spat Margaret.
She sounded like she was about to cry. I blinked at her, not saying anything, and she continued, really getting her rant on now.
"Do you have any idea what it's like to grow up knowing you're descended from traitors? That once, you would have had this amazing family legacy, this endless parade of heroes and saviors and saints. But some self-absorbed idiots had to take all of that away from you. You're an aberration, a monster-loving plague upon the human race. Your parents are no better than you, and we're going to find them, and we're going to make them pay until my family name is clean. Do you understand me?"
"I understand that you're upset," I said carefully. Also a little obsessive, I thought. "But I'm not your redemption. I'm just a woman who happens to be distantly related to you. And whatever hell the Covenant may have put you through for being a Healy, it's not my fault. Okay? It wasn't me who chose to leave. Or